Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 7-9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
This is continuing coverage of United States versus Sean Diddy Combs from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
There's a moment you don't forget in a courtroom, not because of the words being said, but because of the silence that follows them. On May 17th, that moment belonged to Cassie Ventura. After 4 days on the stand, 4 days of reliving what she described as more than a decade of psychological manipulation, sexual coercion, and physical violence, Cassie sat with tears streaking down her face and said what might be the most honest line of the trial so far. "I'd give that money back if I never had to have freak-offs." And just like that, the courtroom fell quiet. Not because no one had anything to say, but because there wasn't much left to say. Cassie Ventura's final hours of testimony weren't just about storytelling. They were about survival, recounting it, defending it, and reclaiming it. On that Friday morning, Diddy's attorney, Anna Estevao, went in hard. The strategy was clear. Reframe Cassie's past not as one of coercion, but of consent. She pulled up text exchanges from 2012 and 2013, zeroing in on Cassie's own words. Phrases like, "I wish we could have FO'd before you left," using their shorthand for what the defense framed as mutual sexual games. The suggestion that this wasn't trafficking or abuse. This was sex between adults, that Cassie was in on it. Estevao read through messages where Cassie appeared to flirt, joke, or even initiate these interactions. She implied that Cassie wasn't a victim at all, but a willing, even enthusiastic participant in the very activities she now claims were traumatizing. It was a cold, clinical dissection of text bubbles and emojis, an attempt to shrink years of alleged trauma into punchy lines of digital banter. It felt like trying to sum up a hostage situation by looking at postcards. Then came the deeper cut. Estevao argued that Cassie didn't just participate. She benefited. She reminded the jury that after settling her civil lawsuit against Combs for $20 million, Cassie abruptly canceled her music tour through Australia and New Zealand, implying, not subtly, that maybe the cash was enough to retire the trauma narrative, that maybe this was about leverage more than justice. Cassie didn't flinch at the accusation. That wasn't the reason why, she said plainly. No theatrics, just exhaustion. When Estevao pointed out that Cassie had stood by Combs' side at red carpet events, appeared with him at the Met Gala, and enjoyed access to the music industry through their relationship, Cassie didn't deny it. "Yup," she said, even admitting that some opportunities were given while others were earned. But the acknowledgement wasn't the concession Estevao seemed to be looking for. It was more like a weary nod to reality. Yes, she had proximity to power, but at what cost? Then came the sharp pivot to one of the most serious allegations, the 2018 rape. Estevao tried to unspool the timeline, pointing out that shortly after the night Cassie says she was raped, she had a consensual encounter with Combs. Even more, Estevao said, Cassie never texted Combs accusing him of rape. The suggestion being, if it happened, why no accusation at the time? Cassie's answer didn't come with fire. It came with restraint. She calmly clarified the dates. The FaceTime from her now husband, Alex Fine, didn't interrupt the alleged assault. It came during a later consensual encounter. When asked about telling Fine what happened, she described his reaction simply, "He punched a wall." The implication was there, but unspoken. You don't need to scream to be believed. Sometimes it's the quiet that says the most. Estevao kept pushing, reading from Ventura's own statements to investigators in which she said Combs was nice but strangely affectionate on the night in question. At one point, Ventura even suggested that Combs might have been acting erratically due to undiagnosed bipolar disorder. It was an opening for the defense. Maybe he wasn't abusive, just unstable. But Ventura didn't take the bait. She didn't excuse him. She simply acknowledged that, yes, at the time, she was trying to make sense of what had happened in the only way she knew how. Finally, the cross-examination ended, and Prosecutor Emily Johnson took over for redirect. And this is where the emotional tone shifted. Johnson didn't go for new facts. She brought back context. She returned to the text message Estevao had read earlier, the one where Cassie supposedly agreed to a freak off. But this time, Johnson read what came right before it. Cassie telling Combs she had a urinary tract infection and would rather not participate at all. Suddenly, that sexy, suggestive message looked a lot more like compliance under pressure, like someone who wasn't into it but didn't feel she could say no. Johnson also reminded the jury that Cassie isn't gaining anything from testifying here. No lawsuit pending, no payout coming. She's not promoting a book or album. When asked directly whether she had any financial interest in the outcome of this trial, Cassie said, "Absolutely not." And that's when the courtroom began to shift, when the focus turned from text messages and settlements to something much harder to cross-examine: raw human pain. When Johnson asked her if she had any doubt that Combs raped her, Ventura didn't pause. "No," she said. Then the tears came, and they didn't feel performative. They didn't feel tactical. They felt like what they were, the breaking point of someone who spent the better part of a week reliving trauma in public, in front of the man she says caused it. And then came the words that landed like a hammer. "I give that money back if I never had to have freak-offs," she said it while sobbing. Not as a soundbite, but as a truth that had nowhere else to go. Cassie went on to describe how those years made her feel worthless, how she felt like dirt, that she was stripped of autonomy, of self-worth, of the ability to say no and believe it would matter. By this point, she was almost whispering her answers. When Estevao tried to ask a final series of questions in recross, Cassie, clearly drained, said, "My mind is a little all over the place right now." And no one blamed her. Judge Arun Subramanian finally released her from the stand. She stepped down slowly, pregnant, her hands clasped below her stomach. She didn't look back at Combs. She didn't need to. As the courtroom exhaled, you could feel the shift. Whatever else happens in this trial, whatever witnesses take the stand, whatever evidence is introduced, Cassie Ventura's 4 days marked a threshold. Her testimony may not be the whole case, but it became its emotional anchor. And now, with her gone, the government will have to shift gears from personal pain to physical proof. If the jury had spent the past 4 days immersed in Cassie Ventura's trauma, May 17th was the day they walked into the aftermath, the real-world residue of what she said happened behind closed doors. Because after all the testimony about Freakoff's control and power masked as romance, prosecutors gave them something they could see, touch, and quantify. And it started with a hotel room. Special Agent Yasin Binda of Homeland Security took the stand in the afternoon, called not to unpack emotions, but to present what was physically found during the federal raid of Sean Combs' Manhattan suite in September 2024. No metaphor, no speculation, just a detailed walkthrough of what investigators saw when they entered what they now describe as a highly curated environment of sexual control. The place wasn't set up like a hotel room. It was set up like a stage. Binda's team executed the arrest and search at the Park Hyatt, a luxury location, sleek and sterile by design. But what they found inside Combs's private suite didn't match the exterior polish. The jury learned that the room had been customized with soft blue mood lighting. Professional-grade lighting rigs were positioned in corners, not exactly what you'd expect in a business trip overnight bag. But what stood out most wasn't the aesthetics, it was the inventory. Binda testified that agents discovered multiple Ziploc bags filled with bottles of Johnson's baby oil and various lubricants, industrial amounts, not the kind you toss in a drawer just in case. One bathroom had 5 separate bottles sitting in the bathtub. More were stored in a nightstand drawer beside the bed. To the prosecution, it was a one-for-one match with Cassie Ventura's earlier testimony about what was kept on hand for the so-called freak-offs, events She said she was coerced into, often drugged, sometimes filmed, and rarely given the option to refuse. And then there were the drugs. Hidden among Combs' personal items, agents recovered pill bottles containing ketamine and MDMA, both powerful substances known to lower inhibition, increase compliance, and in some cases erase memory. But these weren't prescriptions written for Sean Combs. They were labeled for Frank Black, an alias Combs had allegedly used in various contexts over the years. Not a pseudonym scrawled on a hotel sign-in sheet, but a name printed on prescription labels tied to powerful, controlled substances. Prosecutors highlighted this discovery not as some novelty or vanity move, but as a red flag. It suggested intent, planning. A double life shielded by aliases and pharmaceutical access. In addition to the drugs and sex-related materials, Binda's team found a black fanny pack stuffed with over $9,000 in cash, crisp $100 bills bundled together in what one agent described as a quick access stash. Binda demonstrated this by opening an evidence bag in court and fanning out the bills so the jury could see exactly what was recovered. The point was clear. If Ventura said these encounters weren't about pleasure but power and often involved exchanges of money, here was the money. Sitting in the room, right next to the oils and the drugs. Also recovered an external hard drive. No one, at least not yet, testified about what was on it. The prosecution hasn't introduced its contents and no suggestion was made that it contained recordings of the alleged freak-offs, but its presence alone raised eyebrows. Why travel with a separate drive? Why keep it close in a hotel room that's already doubling as a personal dungeon? These weren't rhetorical questions. They were left hanging in the courtroom air. Agent Binda's testimony was methodical. She wasn't offering theories. She wasn't emotional. She was simply describing what was found during a court-approved search, and by the time she stepped down, she had quietly reinforced nearly every logistical element of Cassie Ventura's claims without once needing to reference Ventura by name. If Cassie gave the why, Binda had just provided the where and the what. But the prosecution wasn't finished. Just before the day ended, they introduced another voice, one who hadn't yet testified in this trial, but whose proximity to Combs dated back more than a decade. Singer Dawn Richard. Richard, best known as a former member of Danity Kane and later part of Diddy, Dirty Money, walked into court to give the kind of testimony that doesn't need interpretation. She didn't speculate on intent or emotion. She described what she saw. In 2009, Richard said, she was at Combs' home in Los Angeles with Cassie Ventura. They were in the kitchen making eggs. It was, by her account, a normal moment. Until it wasn't. Combs came down the stairs in a rage, shouting about where his food was and why it wasn't ready. Then, in front of Richard, he allegedly grabbed the skillet Cassie was using and swung it at her head. Cassie dropped to the floor to avoid being hit, curling up in a defensive position. Richard said Combs responded by punching and kicking her while she was on the ground. The jury heard how the assault allegedly didn't stop there. Richard testified that Combs wrapped his arm around Cassie's neck and dragged her upstairs by her hair as she screamed. It was raw and chilling. But what stuck with jurors might not have been the violence itself, it was the aftermath. According to Richard, Combs acted as if nothing had happened. The next day, he invited her and another bandmate to his studio and offered what can only be described as a warped explanation. He allegedly said that what they saw was passion, that this was just how he expressed love, and then came the line that froze the room. He told them, "Where I come from, people who talk end up missing." That wasn't just a rationalization, it was a warning. Don't report what you saw, don't speak out, don't cross me. Richard's testimony brought something new into the courtroom. Independent corroboration from someone who wasn't romantically involved with Combs, who wasn't suing him, and who had no legal stake in this trial. It expanded the narrative. If Cassie had described a pattern of private coercion, Richard introduced the public violence that surrounded it. The defense unsurprisingly objected. As soon as the jury was dismissed for the day, Combs' legal team argued to the judge that Richard's account should be stricken. They said it was too old, too prejudicial, and irrelevant to the charges at hand, which center on sex trafficking, coercion, and conspiracy, not domestic violence from 2009. But the prosecution fired back. They said this wasn't about isolated violence. It was about pattern, about a climate of fear, about how witnesses were controlled, silenced, and made complicit by force or by threat. In their view, Richard's testimony showed exactly how Combs maintained the ecosystem Ventura had described, through dominance, intimidation, and calculated aftershocks of terror. Judge Arun Subramanian didn't rule right away. He said he would take the motion under advisement, that he needed to weigh whether this testimony would help the jury understand the larger picture or unfairly tip the scales against the defendant by dredging up unrelated allegations. So the day ended not with a verdict or even a ruling, but with a pause. The kind of pause that tells you the next move could redefine the trial's momentum. The government had spent the morning grounding Ventura's allegations in physical space, hard objects, and seized materials. By the afternoon, they had cracked the door open on something even more unsettling. What happens when violence isn't just part of a relationship, but part of a system?
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
Well, I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, How to Best Kill Somebody with a Knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.